Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, this is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today, I'm joined by Lee Drutman, author of Breaking the Two-Party Doom Loop, The Case for Multi-Party Democracy in America. This was recently published by Oxford University Press, and it is a really fascinating discussion of options. Options. You say we have options, Lee, for more party activity in the United States and how this potentially can break through some of our current impasses. But first, I'd like to welcome Lee Drutman to the podcast and ask him to tell us a little bit about himself and how he came to this particular project. Hi, Lee.
Hi, Lily.
So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, about me. So I am a senior fellow in the political reform program at the New America Think Tank in Washington, D.C., which is a great place to be to do public-oriented scholarship. I did a PhD in political science from the University of California, Berkeley. This is my second book. My previous book was The Business of America is Lobbying, which is somewhere in the New Books in Political Science archives, if folks want to listen to that interview as well.
And how did you come to this project on essentially how we're going to get out of our current impasse?
Well, this hyperpartisanship is really bad, huh?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. So, you know, I was looking around for what might be a way to get out of it. And you know, I started looking at the history and how we got here. And I then started looking around the world and really digging into comparative politics research. And it seemed to me that maybe the cause of so much of this hyperpartisanship was that we have just two parties. And they're equally balanced at a national level, competing for that constant elusive majority. And they're deeply divided by identity, by geography, by culture. This is really an unsustainable situation. It doesn't work with our political institutions, which demand broad compromise. Doesn't work with our minds, which are very prone to us against them thinking. And it's really not the norm among advanced democracies to have just two parties. The U.S. is a strange country. Most countries are proportional multi-party democracies. And while certainly they have their problems, they don't have this binary hyper-partisanship that's tearing the country in half and making it impossible to do almost anything in Washington.
And so a couple sort of legs into that. The current state, you talk about the fact that this is a kind of unique situation for the United States in a comparative context. And as political scientists, we look often at different governmental systems and different party structures. Can you talk a little bit about that, the comparison between what we have in the United States and what most other democracies have in terms of the party functions?
Yeah, well, most other democracies have multi-party systems, usually as a result of proportional electoral systems, although the UK has sort of a 2.5 party system with similar parties, so does Canada. I think parties in the US are very strange by comparative standards because they are just these very broad, big tent parties that are quite weak. They're quite weak. I think partially because of primaries, which deprive parties of control over their nominees, but also because they have to be these very broad, sprawling parties in order to appeal to enough groups and voters in order to win elections, which makes them hard to steer. Smaller parties can be stronger. So I think that, you know, understanding how the U.S. is different really helps us to understand what the range of possible options might be. I do think that there is something unique about this current period, and probably for the last decade, is that we've actually had two genuine parties and that are truly distinct at the national level and have no overlap. I mean, for a long time, the critique of the American party system, this came from political science for a very long time, was that the parties were incoherent. They didn't stand for anything. They were these loose jumbles of state and local parties that at the national level had no programmatic consistency, didn't offer clear alternatives to the voters. And, you know, I think there's certainly something valuable about having clear choices. But the problem is now we have choices that are so clear and so existential that it's driving us all insane.
And so in that context, can you talk a little bit about that assessment that we have these two parties? And this has kind of been the case just not that long in terms of, as you say, there's no overlap, that the sort of sorting out of who is in which party has made the parties themselves more clearly distinct.
Yeah. So, you know, again, for most of our political history, the national parties didn't really do anything more than just nominate presidential candidates every 4 years. Politics was really about state and local parties. You know, politics began to nationalize in the 60s in reaction to the civil rights revolution. And, you know, then for a while, I would say we had something like a four-party system with liberal Republicans and conservative Democrats alongside liberal Democrats and conservative Republicans. A lot of the liberal Republicans came from New England. A lot of the conservative Democrats came from the South. And, you know, as the parties drew sharper distinctions at a national level, voters cared more and more about which party was in control of Congress. And it became harder for voters in New England to support Republicans, even if they were liberal Republicans, because they saw the Republican Party as much more culturally conservative. And in a winner-take-all system of single-member districts, once your party falls below 40% or so, it's really hard to sustain a party operation. So over the last several decades, you've seen the Republican Party as a party really retreat from New England and coastal areas and cities, where it once used to be somewhat competitive. And you've seen the Democratic Party retreat from a lot of parts of the South and a lot of parts of rural and exurban America. And so what you have now is a party system where the parties really only operate in areas where they are dominant. But even there, they don't really have much of an operation. Every election hinges on a handful of swing states, which means that most voters in the country are treated as irrelevant by the parties, except when it comes to primaries. And it's just a really, when you think about the idea of democracy, that the vote of the people matters, we have a system that really doesn't match much of what we think of as an ideal for how democracy should work. It's very strange, actually, when you stop and think about it and get out of the water that you're swimming.
So in this question, as you say, sort of, do we actually have democracy given how it sort of functions and whose vote really matters? I live in Wisconsin, so my vote matters a little bit more.
Your vote matters, yeah.
than if I lived in California or Texas, perhaps, or Wyoming. And I talk to my students about this on a regular basis. But you also have this discussion within the book itself as well, with regard to the original prospect for this system. And there's been a lot of discussion about that in the last couple of weeks as well, what the framers' intentions were. There are always questions about what the framers' intentions were, as if we could read their minds. And we can read the Federalist Papers.
and if they were all of one mind.
Exactly, which is, you know, then that is also the case, of course. So in terms of having this kind of perhaps not fully functioning democracy in terms of parties, what is the overlay with regard to the system as designed as well?
Well, so, I mean, when I think of the design of the system, I do think a lot about James Madison, who was really the intellectual architect. And, Madison, as well as many of the other framers and founders, were really afraid of political parties forming. And so they set up a series of institutions that were designed to make it really hard for political parties as majority parties to form, bicameral legislature, separation of powers, federalism. And I say majority parties because that's what they had in mind when they thought about parties, that they thought that the greatest danger would be if there was a dominant majority party, because what would happen, they feared, was that dominant majority party would use its power to oppress a minority party. And then the minority party would say, well, this system's not legitimate. And then you basically see a breakdown of democracy. Now, Madison's Federalist Number 10, it's a classic essay. Every political scientist knows it. But the vision is, the key to long-term stability of self-governance is a system in which no one faction feels like it can be permanently dominant, and no one faction feels like it's going to be permanently dominated, and that you have coalitions that come and go and are responsive to a broad consensus majority. And to me, that's much closer to a vision of multi-party democracy than narrow majoritarian democracy, which is what we sort of have, except we sort of don't have it because we have all this separation of powers. So we kind of have the worst of both worlds. We have an electoral system that forces us towards narrow majoritarianism, or we have the worst combination, an electoral system that forces us towards narrow majoritarianism, and an institutional governing structure that forces us towards broad compromise. So to me, it's easier and also more desirable to change the electoral system that would push us towards more multi-partyism, which would encourage more coalition formation, more compromise-oriented, which works with our system rather than against us. I mean, some folks might say, well, we ought to have more of a Westminster-style British system. I don't think that's working out so well. And that leads to even more minoritarian governance, I fear, because you look at the conservatives who are governing in Britain now, and they only won with 43% of the vote in the last election.
And so you talk about how we're going to get out of this quagmire.
And yeah, let's get out of the quagmire. I'm tired. who wants?
And what you're talking about is that we have to actually bust out of the party structure as it currently exists. And so your book talks about how we're going to do that. So what are the steps? How are we going to make this happen, Lee?
Well, as most political scientists know, the number of parties is a function of the electoral system, and we have first past the post electoral system, which tends towards just two parties, particularly with presidentialism on top of it. And if we want to expand the number of parties, break the zero sum binary contest for narrow but elusive majoritarian control, we need to change the way we vote. I'm a fan of ranked choice voting, particularly with multi-member districts, which is a form of proportional representation used in Ireland, used for the Australian Senate. I do that for our House. For the Senate, I think we're stuck with single winner elections, but I'd add ranked choice voting. I'd also increase the size of the House to add more diversity to the House and get rid of primaries, which I think would also encourage more parties competing in the general election. And there are other reasons why I think primary elections are not so great. I think those things together would move us in the direction. Ultimately, I'd like to see a constitutional amendment to replace the Electoral College with a national popular vote that is either a two-round system or a ranked choice voting system, which I think would also make a lot of sense. But I think there's nothing in our Constitution that says we have to have just two parties. The Elections Clause says Congress can decide how to run elections. And I think had the framers acknowledge that political parties are essential vehicles and institutions for modern mass democracy to function, and had they understood the ways in which the electoral rules that they imported unthinkingly from Britain contribute to just two parties, they might have thought a little bit more about how to institutionalize more multi-party democracy. Now, of course, proportional representation wouldn't really be developed until the 19th century and wouldn't be implemented in a widespread way until the early 20th century. But you know, the framers were great consumers of political science, and you know, I think if they had looked at the political science literature, of today, they would have come to very different conclusions. And I also note that when the U.S. sets up helps advise on democracies around the world, nobody ever recommends our cockamamie system of governance.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I always note that to my students when we're studying the Electoral College, and note that nobody else has one. And there's a reason for that. And so in this context, can you talk a little bit about ranked choice voting? About 20 years ago, I was living in Minnesota, and we were discussing it at the time as a form of electoral reform in Minnesota in particular, because we had more viability with regard to multi-parties in the state. Jesse Ventura had been elected governor. And you talk about this at some length in the book. Can you explain about how this would potentially break up the doom loop?
Well, the reason that third parties and fourth parties don't get any traction in our system is that they're treated as spoilers. Now, ranked choice voting takes away that spoiler problem, because you can vote for a third party or a candidate that doesn't seem like it's going to get he or she is going to get the majority of the votes, and then you can indicate a backup second choice, backup third choice preference, so that your vote is going to be counted no matter what, which then encourages candidates to run outside of the two major parties, and for voters to take those candidates seriously, and for those candidates to really introduce new ideas into the political debate stream, particularly if you add multi-member districts rather than single-member districts, which we have now for Congress, that gives you a form of proportional representation that would translate into greater representation for multiple parties. And you know, I think that would be incredibly healthy because, one, it would reflect the broad diversity of this country better. America is a very broad, diverse, pluralistic country. And to shoehorn everybody into one of those two parties, I think leaves an awful lot of voters feeling unrepresented and unhappy. The U.S. has among the lowest turnout rates of any advanced democracy. And you know, there's a good reason that proportional multi-party democracies have a higher turnout rate. And it's because voters are more likely to find a candidate and a party that they feel represents them. And those candidates and those parties are more likely to reach out to voters because in a proportional system, every vote matters. You don't have to live in Wisconsin, as lovely as it is, in order for your vote to count in a Senate or a presidential election. And you don't have to live in a swing district in order for your vote to count in a House election.
And so in terms of solving some of the sort of binary situation, obviously ranked choice voting, as you say, would allow for more voices and more perspectives to be sort of taken into consideration by voters. And when you go to vote, obviously you get to make more than one choice, which is really where I think the sort of understanding of how diverse and pluralistic the country is which also goes to the argument that Madison makes in Federalist 10 and 51, that he expected that just the geography would lead us to be diverse in our politics. Would the ranked choice voting sort of then work in the system better than the current situation that we have?
Well, I think absolutely. I mean, we are less geographically, we've become more nationalized than we were in Madison's time, but ethnically, culturally, I think we're much more diverse. And so it makes sense to have a voting system that represents that diversity, which is, not necessarily always represented well by states as the unit of counting, but rather by people as the unit of counting. And, I think changes to our electoral system would allow that diversity to be much better represented in our system of government than it is right now.
And so the question of the states as the unit of counting, which goes to the Electoral College and also goes to the Senate, that again, at the time of the founding, they were sort of moving away from the states in the Articles of Confederation. But the states seem to be sort of also a difficulty in having a voice, giving voice to many of the voters. Is there parts of your proposal that sort of get at some of these questions of the role of the states?
Well, I think there's always been a debate about federalism and how much power should the states have versus the federal government. Certainly the trend has been towards much more power in Washington and less power in the states. And I think that's probably here to stay. But I think there are certainly opportunities for more localism, particularly at the city level as cities become larger and more important. But I think a lot of that, depends on understanding that there is some room for experimentation. And one of the challenges is that given the high stakes of every election, the side in power in Washington wants to use that power when it gets it to make it harder for states and cities. So we have this kind of weird fair weather federalism, in which the party that's out of power says, oh, we should devolve power to the states and to the cities. Well, maybe not to the cities, depending on which side you're on, cities or the states, depending on which side you're on. But then that goes away. So it's sort of in many ways, it feels like we have an incoherent system in which it's set up with states as the units. But so much of the focus has been on national politics because the stakes of national politics have become so high, so emotional, and the states just become proxies for those battles. If the stakes of control in Washington were less high, if there was more coalitional compromise-oriented politics, I think we would see more interesting stuff happening at the state level and at the city level again.
And so one of the other proposals that you suggest is to expand the House of Representatives. How would this, besides having more people in the House, thus potentially more diversity of perspectives, how would this potentially break up some of this, the sort of binary doom loop?
Well, I think it works well with moving to multi-member districts with ranked choice voting because it allows for more states to have larger districts. And it also, I think, makes it more appealing for incumbent politicians to support expanding the House while expanding to larger districts. It makes it more likely for them to keep their seats. So it makes it more politically possible. I also think it's desirable. The House is supposed to be the people's chamber and the representatives are supposed to be close to the people. And districts started out at about 30,000 constituents per representative. They're now at over 750,000 constituents per representative, which is the highest among all advanced democracies. Only India has higher, but they're a much more federal system than we are. I think in order for people to feel close to their government and the government to feel close to their people, we should have a house in which members represent a smaller number of constituents. frankly, you know, 700 is, I think, a reasonable compromise. I would, if it were up to me entirely, I would go more like 1600 or 2000. But I think that's a little too much. So I've settled on 700, which is consistent with the cube root law that predicts the size of the house based on the country's population.
And do you think at that level of the number of people in the house, things would get done?
Are things getting done now?
Now?
I'm not sure it's a function of the number of people. I mean, it's the house has already gotten too big to have that kind of one-on-one relationship that members have. You know, I think I think things can get done. Qualitatively, I'm not sure how much of a difference it makes from 435 to 700. If you vote on things can get done.
Exactly. And so with regard to one of the sort of other points that you make in terms of reforms, you do advocate for a constitutional amendment to get rid of the Electoral College. And I point this out, you know, it's something that has been advocated since almost the time of the Constitution's inception. Because it's a strange construction that has lots of weird parts to it. Is there a capacity in the country these days for a constitutional amendment to get rid of the Electoral College? It seems to depend on which side of the partisan divide you're on.
Well, this is why it's important to break the two-party doom loop. I mean, as long as it's a partisan issue, and unfortunately, a lot of these democracy reforms that we're talking about in this moment, whether it's making it easier for people to vote, whether it's dealing with gerrymandering and districting, are partisan issues because there's one party that benefits from the status quo and one party that would benefit from change. Not naming any names, although I think you can figure out living in Wisconsin. And, you know, I think that creates a real challenge for a lot of these democracy reforms that we're discussing. Now, one of the nice things about changing the electoral system and blowing up both parties is that it is an equal opportunity destroyer. So both parties will be against it. So it doesn't benefit one party or the other. But frankly, I think there are a lot of representatives, particularly in Washington, who are sick and tired of being part of this partisan trench warfare and working in an institution that everyone talks about how miserable it is. So I think it's a leap to think about a big democracy reform like this. But on the other hand, it seems like we can't keep going the way that we're going, and there's really no way out. You know, there are some folks who think, oh, if only Democrats could just win enough seats in the House and the Senate and just destroy the Republican Party. I don't see that happening anytime soon. I think there's an enthusiasm now that Democrats might gain the trifecta in 2021, but even that is a 50-50 shot, I think. And, you know, what if Trump is gone, suddenly Democrats are going to have a lot less to run against, and you won't see the same mobilization and enthusiasm for Democrats. There'll be a backlash to whoever the Democrat is in the White House. We know this. We have predictable models that show that we have this is thermostatic. So that doesn't seem a way forward. And I don't know. Are we just going to learn to love each other a little more? I don't know. More civility. I'm not sure that's the right answer either.
Well, and the question, of course, of more civility is what does more civility look like and how does it happen? You're proposing sort of structural and political reforms that have, you know, that be nice to each other. Okay. We say that to my children. but I had a question or a sort of, I would love for you to talk about a little bit how this shift in terms of ranked choice voting and sort of broader coalition representation would also change the kind of dynamic around campaigning and to some degree politics, because in order to get to be somebody's second choice or somebody's third choice, or somebody's fourth choice even, you can't necessarily drive a negative campaign for your election. Can you talk a little bit about how that itself might bring some of these questions of civility forward?
Yeah, well, I think one of the experiences of cities that have adopted ranked choice voting thus far is that they've seen a more positive sum campaigning in which candidates are reaching out to more voters who might not be their first, who might not pick them as their first choice, but they're campaigning for second and third choice preferences. And they're building coalitions and alliances with candidates who they might otherwise attack. It's notable that when scholars and democracy experts are called on to think about what voting systems might work in countries that were divided by ethnic civil war, they almost always recommend some form of ranked choice preferential voting, because it's a way for ethnic groups that are have previously been at war with each other to actually try to reach out and build alliances in order to get elected. So I think that is that would be a positive benefit of ranked choice voting as a form of voting. I agree with you that civility is, it's a hand wavy thing. Civility for who? I think politics is about conflict, because the things that we agree on are the things that we don't have political debate over, right? They're not political issues. The political issues are the issues where we don't otherwise agree, and that's fine and that's healthy. But the challenge is we've got to find a way to resolve those issues. And if everything is cast in this existential good versus evil, no compromise situation, no alliance situation, we can't resolve those issues.
And so there are cities, and I know the state of Maine have adopted ranked choice voting. Can you talk a little bit about how the places where it has been adopted in the United States, how that's going and what they're, how they got there also?
Well, I think it's mostly going well. Cities tend to be happy with ranked choice voting. Voters, after doing it once, they say, oh, this was actually simpler than I thought it was going to be. And hey, the campaign was a little less negative this time. How they got there, each place has its own story of how it got there, but usually what you'll find is a combination of dissatisfaction with the way things are working, and a real grassroots movement, and a real campaign of voters saying, look, I want more choices. I want to be able to express the full range of my preferences. And that's in the broad history of democracy reform, democracy reform happens, when people feel like the status quo is intolerable, and social movements build around that. It took a long time to get women's suffrage, there was a real social movement around that. It took a long time to get civil rights. There was a real social movement around that. A lot of the progressive reforms, which I think are other progressive democracy reforms, which I think are not necessarily so great. Kind of mixed bag. Referendum and initiative, direct primary, direct election of senators. Those all happened in this country, and there was a big movement that said the way we're doing business, the way we're running our democracy, is not acceptable. We want something that's more inclusive, more responsive. And when enough folks demand it, and politicians eventually realize, oh, actually, the system that we have is kind of sucky, and I could still get elected in a different system, and it might actually be better. Then you get reform.
And so in terms of reforming our democracy, this is going to be a sort of potentially a piecemeal undertaking in terms of places adopting ranked choice voting, or potentially legislation to expand the House of Representatives. Obviously, amendments to the Constitution often are long-term undertakings. So how would you see this unfolding, as you say, in terms of social movements and people getting really, really, really frustrated with how things are going in Washington, which seems to be, in a certain sense, the election of Donald Trump was a reflection of that as well.
Yeah. And the election of Donald Trump was both a reflection of the frustration and a wake-up call to a lot of folks that the system that we have maybe isn't so great. And I think one of the things that you've seen in polling is that there's been a shift in the number of Americans who say that maybe our system of government isn't actually the best. I think realistically what you'll see is more states following the path of Maine and changing, taking changes into their own hands. I think you'll start to see some states experimenting with different forms of electoral reform for their own state legislature. And I think you'll see more and more energy building around electoral reform as more and more people realize that if we keep doing what we're doing, we are really running a dangerous risk, because fundamentally self-governance democracy depends on a sense that there is a way to productively disagree and then to resolve those disagreements. Relies on a shared underlying process that is fair, that is legitimate, and we are rapidly losing that. I mean, you look at the number of people who will probably view whatever happens in the 2020 election as illegitimate. You look at the way in which the impeachment has gone down. We are a country in which there are two separate realities for two separate parties. And that is a very, very dangerous place to be. And I think as the stakes continue to escalate, we will see more and more challenges that at some point, I don't know if we will withstand.
So that the sort of basis of the democracy itself is with regard to the question of legitimacy, is the question of self-government and sort of trusting yourself and your neighbors. But also the folks that you elect and the way that they function in office. Right. There is this question about how many people are voters. As you know, we have very low turnout, and it varies state by state also. That's often connected to how much you think, how valuable and legitimate you think the government is in your state. As I've sort of lived in Florida, and I've lived in Minnesota, which are often the extremes of some of those questions. So, Lee, this is a very exciting book, very hopeful and optimistic. So what are you working on now?
Well, I'm thinking about what the next big project is going to be at this point. I'm sort of interested in the broad history of democracy reform in the U.S. and how other movements and bursts of democracy reform have gone, and thinking more broadly about how different movements have reconciled different trade-offs of democracy.
And so when that project is concluded, I hope you will come on the New Books Network and talk to me about it again.
All right, I'll see you in about 5 years.
Okay. I was joined by Lee Drutman today, who's author of Breaking the Two-Party Doom Loop, The Case for Multi-Party Democracy in America. This is published by Oxford University Press, and I'm sure one can pick up a copy of this at the Oxford University Press website. Any place else you'd like to give a shout out to?
Or wherever you like to buy books, maybe your local independent bookstore, if that exists in your town.
That is, of course, an option for many people. Thank you for joining me today, Lee.
Pleasure to be with you, Lily.